I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. I would like to welcome Michael Briguglio from the Department of Sociology within the Faculty of Arts here at the University. He's been working on an interesting initiative involving a postgraduate workshop, which has taken place at the University of Oxford. Welcome, Michael. This postgraduate workshop, how did it come to be?
This is a workshop which is organized by the Social Policy Association of Britain, which is one of the leading social policy associations in the world, and it was advertised through their mailing lists and other networks for postgraduate students who would like to discuss some of their research, including their doctorates, if they are carrying out a doctorate on a specific issue which they would like to discuss. And basically, I applied together with Maria Brown. We gave them a copy of some research which we had carried out and which is based on Maria Brown's master's degree. And basically it was accepted, and we joined this workshop. We participated together with other postgraduate students from different countries around the world.
I gather that this project is Grundtvig-run or Grundtvig-funded.
Yes, the workshop specifically isn't Grundtvig-funded. But there were participants who were funded from different programs. Now, Maria Brown and myself were funded through the Grundtvig project. Now, the Grundtvig project is an EU fund. It's a new project. And within it, you will find various associations, various initiatives, and various workshops which are approved by Grundtvig. And this was one of them.
This is an association in Britain which is obviously interested in hearing from postgraduate students from around the world, looking at the list of...
Yes. In fact, there were participants from Pakistan, for example, from Scotland, from India, from various parts of the world. And many of us, we were rather young in our age. Many of us, I'm a lecturer, but I'm still a student because I'm reading for a doctorate.
And you're still a young chap. And what about the content of this particular workshop? Was there an overarching theme through it, or was it sort of dealing with different issues?
The workshop was entitled Social Policy in Developing and Transitional Economies, Challenges and Possibilities. So basically we had to focus on economies and societies, which are not the fully developed societies such as Sweden and Britain and whatever, but rather societies which either have middle income levels or low income levels, or else they are somewhere in between. Now, Malta is, it's not a highly developed country, but it's somewhere above the middle income country. So in a way we fit in this workshop. So the common theme was that we had to analyze social policy challenges for such societies. Now, some presentations focused on really poor societies. Others, like ours, focused on societies which are not as developed as Sweden, for example, but we are very much on the way.
Before going into a little bit of detail about your particular paper, perhaps we could have a look at some of the ones that I see were given during this workshop. They're all extremely interesting subjects and all clearly extremely topical issues. I was looking at that one entitled The Conceptual Framework for Community-Based Health Insurance in Low-Income Countries, Social Capital and Economic Development. That sounds very interesting. Do you remember anything of that paper?
Yes, basically, this came from a student from the London School of Economics, and she tried to show how healthcare is affected not only by economic variables, but also by social capital. What is social capital? Social capital has to do with networks, with trust. Sometimes it's not only your income, which counts as regards your healthcare, but also the people you know. Now, when I say the people you know, I'm not referring to this in a negative way, but sometimes networks are very important in a society. You may be poor, but you have a lot of social networks. Now, in a small society like Malta, for example, networks are very important, because people might help each other out just because they live next door to them, for example. And if you live in small communities, social networks tend to be very much used by many people.
And we have the extended family network, yes, as well, yes, which is not so common in UK.
Yes. In fact, for example, in Malta, 2/3 of people who marry or who go to live somewhere else live in the same locality as their original family.
And picking up on another one about the call centres in India, that was an interesting take on call centres.
Yes, that this was one of the most lively presentations I remember, because the presenter, she's called Sweta Rajan, from the University of Oxford. Her approach, it was very lively. And she focused on the challenges and contradictions which call center workers are facing in India. She was focusing specifically on young females who, on the one hand, would like to have their own independence through their income, through their employment, and so forth. But on the other hand, they have certain contradictions. For example, they work very long working hours. If they would like to start a family, for example, it's practically impossible. Perhaps their own families do not really enjoy the fact that they work. There are a lot of social and cultural variables which one has to put into context. And call centers, sometimes they are presented as the new economic model. Now, it is true, call centers provide a lot of jobs. But on the other hand, the work conditions at call centers are not so rosy.
In fact, I've seen a couple of documentaries on the BBC about call centres, and frankly, they did look as though the workers were slightly put upon, really, as far as hours are concerned, and it's not just a case of shift work, but also very. It's a very stressful,
yes,
occupation.
You're always on the go, basically.
That's it. Were there some others that stuck in your memory?
Yes, there was one. It focused on the privatization of healthcare in Eastern Europe by David Stuckler. He's a student at the University of Cambridge. And, I mean, his presentation, it was the last presentation. It left us almost breathless. It was a really fast presentation. And he had so many statistics, and he used so much quantitative data to show the relationship between privatization and people's health. Now, he found out that in Eastern Europe, people's longevity rates, for example, have gone down in societies which have privatized their healthcare the most. For example, he mentioned Russia, and he gave us a lot of examples of longevity rates which are going down, but also increase in suicide rates, for example, increase in alcoholism, and so forth. And he tried to show this relationship between the privatization of healthcare and these results. Now, perhaps one might not agree with his findings, but his findings were very convincing, because he showed us a lot of statistics and a lot of other quantitative variables which were really convincing.
And in fact, this kind of experience would give somebody like yourself, who is a young academic, just sort of starting off on the paper trail, giving him or her an opportunity to stand up amongst other people who you don't know, coming from different cultures, giving you an opportunity to test also not only your intellectual skills, but also your presentation skills and your networking skills.
Yes, in fact, it's a form of social capital, to go back to what we were saying previously. Because through such workshops, one can meet other academics who have similar interests. We further our horizons, but we also learn from our mistakes, perhaps. Perhaps there might have been some parts in each presentation which could have been arranged. For example, I remember Sweta's presentation, the one on call centers. It was really good, but there were some gaps, and many of us asked questions, and indirectly we were helping her improve her doctorate, and she was really thankful for this. For example, in our presentation, there were some parts which we could have improved, and we did, and in fact, our presentation, we have written a paper based on our presentation, and it's going to be published very soon in a journal called Societies Without Borders.
So before asking you to go into a little bit of detail about your particular paper, I'd just like to remind listeners that this is Research Matters, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm talking to Michael Briguglio from the Department of Sociology here at the University So, Michael, perhaps you can tell us more about your particular paper that you gave, as you've said, with Maria Brown.
Yes. First of all, this was based on empirical research which Maria Brown did for her master's degree in sociology. And this research focused on aging unemployed workers in Malta, aged between 40 and 60. Now one might say, why not age between 55 and 60? And this is because the ETC has an EU-funded program for workers between 40 and 60, and they were defined as aging workers, and they were an ideal target group for empirical research in order that one may verify their perceptions regarding work, employment possibilities, pessimism, discouragement, and so forth. And basically, in this dissertation, Maria Brown found out that the majority of workers found a job through this training program. However, a good number of workers experienced discouragement, which means they were not so optimistic, not necessarily as regards finding a job, but as regards finding a job which is not alienating, a job which they would like to pursue. And she found out that certain workers were more likely to be discouraged than others. For example, this might sound like a contradiction, but those who had the lowest and the highest levels of education were more likely to be discouraged. Now, one might explain this. If you have a very low level of education, a primary level of education, you might not have any job prospect at all. If you have a high level of education and you are an aging worker, you might be wary of indirect discrimination, which unfortunately still happens. Even though it is illegal, some employers do not want to employ aging workers. And basically, the most important finding of this work was that discouragement takes place not only when people are registering for a job, but discouragement can also take place when someone has a job, when someone is also carrying out training courses, for example. Discouragement is an ongoing process. It doesn't start from day one suddenly when someone is unemployed. It can be a process which takes time. And when we have situations, for example, the dockyards situation, when workers know that their future might not be so rosy, this might result in discouragement amongst such workers. So basically, what we tried to focus through this research and through this presentation is that social policy should target unemployed aging workers, not only in a universal way, that is by providing training programs using a one-size-fits-all approach, but also trying to look at the particular realities of such workers. We are living in a society of multiple identities. You're not simply a worker or an aging worker, but you might be an aging worker who has certain perceptions, an aging worker who has a certain cultural background, and so forth. And this is, I think it's a very important message for social policy in general. Social policy should be universal, that is, everyone should have access to healthcare, for example, but at the same time, social policy should be particularistic. It should take account of the individual realities of each and every one of us.
And in fact, a piece of work like this is obviously of interest to policymakers. Are there opportunities for you to put forward your ideas? I think Maria had presented her master's to the ETC.
Yes, she had handed a copy of her master's to the ETC. As I told you, this research is going to be published in a journal called Societies Without Borders, where we also updated the research a little bit, and we included a case study on aging dockyard workers in Malta. But then, I mean, such research is also made use of indirectly, for example, in my sociology lectures, for example, where I will have students who are not only from a sociological background, but I also lecture law students, for example, communication students, and so forth. So there are both direct and indirect ways of putting forward one's research findings.
I think this is an important point to make, because when you're doing a piece of research, obviously at the end of the day, you want it to be in peer-reviewed journals, and that's what you're doing, and that's fine. But I think that people out there would like to also feel that society in general is benefiting from work. It is through the students, and hopefully our students then will, you know, go out. Yes. I mean, that's what university life is all about. Yeah. what about your own PhD? What area is that?
Yes, I'm researching environmental NGOs in Malta, and I'm trying to verify whether they have become empowered through Malta's EU accession process. Now, I haven't carried out the empirical work yet. I've finished my theoretical part. I put forward a hypothesis, and my hypothesis is that most environmental NGOs have become empowered, but they have also become institutionalized. It is as if they have become co-opted. Now, this is like a double-edged sword. On the one hand, when you are co-opted, you have more lobbying power, because you are negotiating with top politicians, you are negotiating with the EU Commission directly, and so forth. But on the other hand, and this has happened with various environmental NGOs around the world, when you are institutionalized, you might move further away from your grassroots. And sometimes members leave NGOs because of this reason. It's a double-edged sword. I mean, environmental NGOs have to play a fine balancing act between being part of the institutions and being outside the institutions. And in fact, I'm also trying to show how the more radical NGOs, to a certain extent, they have become empowered because Malta's, for our environmental laws have been upgraded through EU accession. But on the other hand, Malta's, the more radical NGOs do not experience the same lobbying opportunities which the more mainstream NGOs face.
Yes, I think that's probably a very good argument in favor of diversity amongst the NGOs.
Yes, in fact, leading scholars who have researched environmental NGOs across Europe, such as Chris Roots, for example, has said that both these NGOs need each other. It is as if they form a synthesis through their diversity, because some are more radical and they put forward the more innovative ideas. The others are part of the system and they have more lobbying power with the people who count.
I hear quite often the comment, oh, there's a sort of waste of energy, why don't you get together, and why are you doing something very similar to what seems to the outsider very similar to the another NGO with another name. And I'm always putting forward this argument that diversity is important.
Yes, diversity is important. We can also mention concrete examples. For example, between 1997 and 2004, there was a wide alliance of NGOs, both environmental as well as social and even religious, who were campaigning against the proposed golf course in Rabat. And this was a victorious alliance. And I believe that this was victorious because of the diversity. Because on the one hand, you had, for example, the university chaplaincy. You had Father Jimmy, who was campaigning really hard. On the other hand, you had farmers who were directly involved. You had environmentalists putting forward ecological arguments. You had social NGOs. Incidentally, as a sociology student called Patrick Gallia is going to read for a master's degree on the front against the golf course, and I'm going to be his supervisor. So hopefully, we can prove or disprove this hypothesis. My hunch is that we will prove it.
I think you're right. The NGOs as interface with government is always a little bit problematic to people who are rather purist as far as NGOs is concerned. Their independence is always sort of a little bit at risk. Rather, the perception of their independence is at risk than the independence itself when they become a close interface with government. Have you seen that problem?
I don't think one can draw a straight line, because some environmental NGOs are more institutionalized than others, and some are more bureaucratized than others. Generally, many NGOs, not only environmental NGOs, but others as well, they are more fluid as regards their membership and so forth, and that gives them some, they are also fluid, therefore, also in their strategies and in their political mechanisms. But others, they are less fluid and they are more part of the system. And I'm referring to some larger NGOs. Some, for example, Dinlart Helwa, to give you an example, is more of an institutionalized NGO. It's more rigid in its approach. Now, that has certain strengths. For example, it has more, such NGOs have more access to European funds, which is a strength. But on the other hand, it is a weakness because they might not be able to live up to certain new challenges, which smaller NGOs are more capable of doing. But then smaller NGOs, for example, they do not have as much access to certain opportunities. So again, this is a dialectic of different identities.
And important that there is some sort of networking between the various platforms, because there are opportunities out there. And the fact that a society like Dinlart Helwa would have perhaps the organizational ability to access funds more than another society should mean that they should be able to perhaps also involve other groups. I mean, that's the networking.
Yes, and networking can also take place on a European level, which is very important. It's one of the benefits of EU membership, not only academically, but also as regards NGOs, for example. You might be a small NGO, or you might be a young academic, for example, but through your networks, again, we're discussing social capital, through your networks, you find great opportunities. Now, this Oxford workshop, which we discussed in the beginning of today's program, is an example. But there are also examples of NGOs, for example, who participate in youth exchange programs, for example, NGOs who share information. And networking is something which has really changed our geographical orientation, so to speak.
Absolutely. Well, with NGOs, I suppose the most important thing is that they're independent, and with the new legislation, unless they are completely independent of government, they won't be able to get their BO number. So hopefully we've moved definitely in the right direction. For your future projects, obviously your PhD is your biggest project, and that will involve probably some going abroad although you're doing a sort of Maltese subject. How do you see that developing in the future, and what other projects have you got in mind?
As regards the PhD, I mean, I have to, in the coming months, I intend to carry out a lot of interviews with civil society actors themselves, and I shall be using a qualitative approach, which is very time consuming. Mm-hmm. And I am also a member of various environmental sociology subcommittees and so forth. For example, I'm a member of the International Sociology Association, and within it there is an environmental subcommittee. Within it, a lot of networking takes place. But then there are other projects in the future. First of all, again, together with Maria Brown, I intend to participate in the British Sociology Association conference, which will be held next April, I think, in Cardiff. And we intend to carry out a study on young unemployed workers this time, to see why there are what are the perceptions, of young unemployed workers, whether they don't want to work, whether they find they do not have any opportunities, or whether they are working informally, for example. We want to verify that, and I think it's going to be quite an interesting piece of research. And we have also recently participated in the Social Capital Conference, which was held in Malta. This is a huge conference. It was held also 3 years ago. A lot of Maltese academics take part, but unfortunately not many students are there. I don't know if I saw one student, and this was advertised. I mean, people knew about it. It was also advertised in the press, not only within university, that is. And this is a great challenge there will be such a diversity of academics. And in this in this conference, we presented a paper on environmental NGOs and social capital. We tried to see how environmental NGOs in Malta network amongst themselves. And there are other opportunities in the future. I mean, academic life is an ongoing, lifelong process.
That's what it should be. In the particular area of research which you are in mm-hmm. the sociology area, you mentioned the fact that you may have to do qualitative analysis, yes. and therefore have conversations with yes. people, structured, obviously, yes. conversations, yes, but always a conversation yes. rather than just dealing with yes. with data. How easy have you found this in what you've done so far within the Maltese milieu? Has it been quite easy? What have been the problems involved with reaching out to people to hear their opinions?
So far, I mean, even speaking about research of students whom I supervised, for example, there haven't been so many problems as regarding, perhaps one might think that certain people would not like to be interviewed because we're a small society, everyone knows everyone. But, for example, the University of Malta itself has its own ethics committee and so forth, and this committee makes sure that work is confidential, for example. Now, not all work has to be confidential. For example, in my research, I want NGOs to speak out I want them to say what they really think, and they will know about this. But I don't think it will be a problem for them. But if you're carrying out research, for example, regarding mental hospitals, for example, or regarding certain sensitive issues, it could be educational health, it's important that confidentiality is assured. And in fact, there are various procedures which one has to follow, confidentiality letters and so forth, and this ensures that people's privacy is respected.
Especially now that we have the Data Protection
yes,
Act.
Yes, of course, yes.
That is really one yes. thing that is an outside legal
yes,
control.
Yes.
And as you say, we have the Ethics Research Committee because mm-hmm. it should be said that when you put forward your suggestion for your master's or your PhD, even more so, mm-hmm. Here in Malta, it has to go before the Ethics Committee.
Yes, I think, and this is something which I'm quite proud of. I mean, our university, I think it has a very high level. Sometimes even when you see, I mean, dissertations of students and you compare them, our levels are very high. And this is something which even foreign examiners tell us. This year we had a foreign examiner in the sociology department from the University of Manchester, Fiona Devine, who is a world-renowned sociologist. And she told us that the quality of the empirical research of BA students was very high, and this was something which made us feel quite proud. And I think it's something which we should, I mean, really flaunt. I mean, sometimes we tend to be too critical to ourselves, but I think we have a very good quality.
Yes, our external examiners have always, almost without exception, have always been very impressed with the work of our even our undergraduates.
And there are some departments, for example, I'm very much impressed by the Youth Studies and Community Department. It's such an inclusive department. It reaches out to society. It sends these newsletters to many people. I mean, this is something which really should be followed up at university level, I think.
Yes, this is what I think people out in society really would like to hear, that the research that goes on at the university is obviously of a high level, it's intellectually very stimulating, but also the results are actually disseminated for everybody to enjoy. Well, thank you very, very much, Michael Briguglio, for coming to speak to us today on Research Matters. I've enjoyed speaking to such an enthusiastic young lecturer. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.